RB Stereo FM, Carmel by the Sea. Now, the Warren Report, in showing that there was no conspiracy with the oil people or the Dallas community, as we said before, ruled out the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald knew the oil people, which doesn't really hold at all. As I said, he doesn't have to know them. Then they went into Bernard Weissman, and they said, in quotes, "We did a full-scale investigation into the genesis of this advertisement, a full-scale investigation into the genesis of this advertisement and the background of those responsible for it. Three of the four men chiefly responsible were Bernard Weissman, William Burley, and Larry Schmidt, who served together in the U.S. Army in Munich, Germany in 1962. That's what the Warren Report said. What they don't say is that they were counterintelligence decoders, like we said, military policemen. It says they just served together in Munich, Germany. And they were satisfied that these men were not involved in a conspiracy. It says, upon their release from the military service, Weissman and Burley did not immediately move to Dallas. In October the 1st, 1963, Schmidt told them that big things are happening. This is what he wrote to them. Now, when they say they conducted a full-scale investigation, the Warren Report says three of the four men responsible for the ad. They don't mention the fourth man, who is Larry Jones. Why doesn't the Warren Commission say four men were responsible for the ad, four men were in Munich, Germany? The Warren Report that you buy mentions three names and leaves out a fourth name, Larry Jones. Now, the day of the assassination...
Who is Larry Jones?
Well, Larry Jones was one of the men in Munich, Germany, with three men. But why doesn't the Warren Report say four men were together? They said the commission, this is page 295, conducted a full investigation. Three of the four men served together in the U.S. Army in Munich, Germany. Now, when Bernard Weissman, who was allowed to use a fictitious name to hide who paid for the ad, a Jewish name to hide who was behind it, was called before the commission. He was the only member, and I have a list of 28 people who have to be called back to Washington. On page 490 in volume 5, Mr. Jenner said to Bernard Weissman, "What other buddies do you have in the Army with whom you again renewed your acquaintance when you were discharged and went to Dallas?" And Bernard Weissman said, "Only one besides Larry," meaning Larry Schmidt, "and that was Bill Burley." Now, under sworn testimony, he says those were the men in the Fort Worth, Dallas area at the time of the assassination. When I turn to volume 23, a Mr. Siegel from a carpet company that was the front where Mr. Weissman was supposed to be working with Bill Burley when they arrived. They didn't sell a carpet. They didn't call on any person. They weren't peddling carpets, but that is where they checked in. And they were there at a meeting the morning of the assassination. And Mr. Siegel testified that at the end of the meeting, there was a telephone call to, this is volume 18, pardon me, page 846. There was a telephone call to meet Larry Jones for lunch. They'd be at the usual place with his brother, and after the assassination, that noon, they would meet for lunch. The day of the assassination, Larry Jones called, and Bernard Weissman said, "Oh, I don't know who Jones is." But in the volumes, volume 18, 846, you see that Larry Jones was in Munich, Germany. Now, in volume 18, page 890, a gentleman named Ken Glazebrook, a political analysis division of their organization. This group in Munich had an organization called CUSA, C-U-S-A, which we will talk about. And Ken Glazebrook is mentioned when Bernard Weissman was called as a witness. He mentions that he went in Dallas to the bus station on November the 22nd and picked up November 22, 1963, and picked up Ken Glazebrook. Now, Ken's name is in the correspondence. He was in Munich, Germany, and knew these men. Then he went on to the Middle East, and he siphoned into town. And Bernard Weissman is saying before the commission that he picked Ken up November the 22nd, 1963, at the bus station. And in the same testimony to Jenner, he's saying that he didn't know anyone from the German area except two men, Bill Burley and Larry Schmidt. So right there, you see the commission, Mr. Jenner is taking his word that there was Larry Schmidt and Bill Burley in the Dallas area. And when he says, I picked up a friend, Ken, Mr. Jenner hasn't read the correspondence that Ken was in Munich. So the commission lawyers don't even know who the witness is talking about. So there's no way that Jack Anderson can tell me his investigation is going to match my investigation. And it's so serious, Claire. I take it serious. I really do. Because you are being told we've gone into this. He says, my investigation. And he has not gone into it. And I'll show you how the Warren Report made errors in this area and how they got into trouble. They only had 6 pages, as I say, in the whole area. And Don Riley in San Francisco has this 14-page document mentioning people. Now, the Warren Report goes into another handbill, which says wanted for treason, that was printed the 2 days before the assassination and was passed all over town. And the man who did this printing and was involved with it, the Johnson Printing Company, is a partner of General Walker. You have to remember that General Walker was removed from service by the administration because there was so much right-wing activity going on in organizing with the military over in Germany. And the Warren Commission rules out the fact that General Walker knew Ruby. No, they don't say that. They rule out that he knew Oswald. And when they want to go into the back thing, they say that they went into the men who placed that ad, wanted for treason, that handbill, the day of the assassination, the day before it was passed all over the streets. And they were satisfied that Mr. Klaus and Mr. Surrey and General Walker, who all testified, were unequated with Lee Harvey Oswald. This is page 299. The commission found no evidence of any connection between those responsible for the handbill and Lee Harvey Oswald or the assassination. Now, a Howard Duff told the Secret Service that he was an employee of General Walker and saw Jack Ruby in his home 2 times. But Howard Duff was never called because when the Secret Service wanted him, he called his ex-wife and said, I would be killed if I talked. And Howard Duff has never been seen or heard. And the connection of, there is a strata now of, I have to explain, and I'm giving Mr. Jack Anderson, he'll get this tape, and he has 5 weeks to work before Congress comes back if we ever meet. I'm giving him some leads. There were 3 stratas in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. One was a very right-wing, fanatical, extremist group that Don Riley's talking about, connected with the church. Church covers in that area, and they have links all over the country and places in Mexico that they send operatives out of. Then there is another group from Munich, Germany, that moved into town who could meet with these right-wing fanatics and talk about some really heavy things in their letters back and forth that implied that they had no political background. They were doing this for money. They would do anything for money. They met with the money people. They were involved with nightclubs. With the clubs, they banked at the Republic National Bank, which was listed in the Foundation's articles in the New York Times in 1967 as a source of black money. They met at the places where Ruby met, and they were connecting links of all these people. Now, none of those had anything to do with Lee Harvey Oswald. The Warren Report, and going into the assumption that Oswald did the whole thing, want you to think that if Oswald didn't see the oil people, if Oswald didn't know the Munich boys, and if Oswald did it, then none of the others were involved. And if you take a heavy link chain, I did a diagram of a link chain of what it would require to take off an assassination, and you fill in everything, the motorcade, how you get the job, the weapon, and all these things, and if any link is weak, the whole thing won't hold up. But if there are connecting places that tighten that link, then it holds together. So if under the conspiracies, the Warren Commission has ruled out that there's no evidence of a connection because they didn't know Oswald, they didn't have to know Lee Harvey Oswald at all. I think that, now, where did the commission miss the point on a conspiracy? If Don Riley is pointing out his 14-page document, I'll tell you how I came to some of my conclusions and what I think about it. In the first place, they told you they conducted a full-scale investigation. And I have a list, I say a group from Nazi mentality, Nazi talking, about Jews, about blacks, about a white Christian world, a group that was in Munich, Germany, that siphoned into the Dallas-Fort Worth area that the commission didn't call as witnesses. So one of the gross errors is whoever selected the witnesses, and this was controlled, too, by the CIA, they chose the ones that they wanted to hear. And they could say we had the grandest investigation in the whole land. We had 552 witnesses. If they had 30 of those witnesses and the 300 I want, because I have no reason to be selective other than that they seem to know something, I would select different witnesses. So they called the wrong witnesses, and when they meet, maybe we can get 20 or 30 of these other people back. Then there were a group of people who had foreknowledge of the assassination. And I have the name. Somebody, for example, at Knott's Berry Farm would talk about the way Kennedy was being killed 2 weeks before the assassination, or someone in Miami. There's a tape recording of the way Kennedy would be killed. A gun would be taken apart, put together in the building. A man, a decoy, would leave the building. The chief of police in Miami notified the Secret Service, so they airlifted John Kennedy into Miami 2 weeks before the assassination. He didn't want an assassination in Miami, but it happened 2 weeks later in Dallas. So people had foreknowledge of the assassination, and you have to say, what organization, what street do they work on? I have Commerce Street. I have the organizations, the places they meet, the restaurants, the banks, the nightclubs. They all converged. People who had foreknowledge in California, San Antonio, Fort Worth, and Dallas, or Miami, New Orleans, or Alabama, all converged and had a contact on Commerce Street in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. Now, the other problem was that the commission didn't attend the meetings. At the meeting of Bernard Weissman, when he's the only man from this whole area that we're talking about now, was called, and he was only called because he had used his fictitious name in committee, which didn't exist. They really didn't want any more information from him. Bernard Weissman had most of the members of the commission at the meeting, and when he began to talk about a secret organization that wanted to take over the United States government by 1969 or 1972, just when he got on the subject, there is this organization. Chief Justice Earl Warren said, "Will you excuse me, please?" He had something else to do. Now, Earl Warren can always say, "I didn't hear what it was," because he had something else to do. A few minutes later, Bernard Weissman is talking and perjuring himself and leaving things out and not being asked the right questions. Gerald Ford is now chairman, and Gerald Ford says, "Mr. Boggs, would you take over? I have to leave the room." And Gerald Ford leads the room. Then Mr. Boggs takes over. So you're left with Chairman Boggs and Alan Dulles of the CIA to hear Bernard Weissman talk about an organization that wanted to take over the United States government. Now, they didn't call the right people. They didn't attend when the men were talking, they didn't even attend those things. Now, when a witness is using a cover-up, like Bernard Weissman, or a cover story about the use of his name, that there was no organization, he had no purpose in Dallas, and he had heavy contacts, they never were able to follow or check the perjury. They missed there. And when they called a witness, the partner of General Walker, who printed the handbill wanted for treason, he was the only man who used the Fifth Amendment. And I should add up how many times. I have a book of statistics. Maybe it was 20, 30, 40 times. He's the only witness out of 552 witnesses who used the Fifth Amendment to not perjure himself. And in the introduction to the Warren Report, they say, in this investigation, we will not allow the Fifth Amendment to be used because it is so important to get the evidence. So they have, in the minutes of the meeting when the Warren Commission was formed, that they should not allow protection by the Fifth Amendment. And the only man who used it over and over and over again was this particular man out of 552 in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He pleaded the Fifth Amendment. So the link of conspiracy for Mr. Jack Anderson or people who are listening is very, very heavy, Gloria. I will welcome a chance, and you people can write a letter now tonight and say, will the Monterey Herald, this is a good letter to write, or call the Monterey Herald and say, could you please print the Jack Anderson article on the assassination that was in the New Orleans paper, because they get the whole thing. If it was deleted, we have a program that is the only one in the United States on political assassinations. You know, we're unique, and we could jump off the Dallas area and go into that London paper, Gloria. We're unique. This is the only weekly show on the air anywhere talking about political assassinations. And Joe Jostein in Europe, he lives in Gutenberg, Germany. He wrote the very first book on the John Kennedy murder. It was called Oswald, Assassin or Fall Guy. And I'll write the book someday, Oswald, the Decoy to Patsy. He has written 8 books on the Kennedy assassination, and he has a newsletter. Somebody wrote in or called in and wanted a newsletter that I could send out every week, and I don't have the money. If anyone would give me the money, I would do it. You know, it takes time and money to print it and distribute it. And he has a monthly newsletter for researchers who are interested in the assassinations. If any of you want to write to him or subscribe, his name is J-O-A-C-H-I-M, Joachim, I guess it is, J-O-E-S-T-E-N, 7890, Gutenberg, Germany. I'll say that again. Maybe people who want a newsletter, he's right on. He's saying things just as they come off once a month, and you'll get it. And it isn't very expensive. I don't remember the cost. Send him a letter and ask him the cost, and you'll get 4 or 5 pages every month. J-O-E-S-T-E-N, 7890, Gutenberg, Germany. He carries report on the Garrison case, the Los Angeles Police Department, Robert Kennedy, James Ray, the lawsuits, and the Chappaquiddick. Every month he has a newsletter, a continuous thing, a page on what's developed. And I received a letter from him from Germany Friday. I didn't even have a chance to read the newsletter. And this week I received another one, and I read that immediately because it was important. He doesn't send them out that close together. And what was he saying? He was saying that in London, a man who used to work for the Defense Department, Fletcher Prouty, who was a lieutenant colonel, was invited on British broadcasting to talk about the Pentagon Papers and the meaning to American history and what's happening now. And he took London by surprise on the show called 24 Hours and suggested that there was a possible CIA involvement in the killing of the two Kennedy boys. Now, when we went on the air, Gloria, and you asked me to come in and explain our very first dialogue, it was just a rap session on the Pentagon Papers, and I said, we'll have to get into the assassination of John Kennedy. So in Carmel, California, on KLRB, and in London, the London Times carried a headline story, and the Munich paper had a headline, a full-page article, and the headline read, New Charge Against the U.S. Intelligence Agency CIA. Was it responsible for the Kennedy assassination? And Joe Jostein, I told him about our broadcast here, and he's going to have an article in his newspaper about KLRB that will go all over Europe, and I've written several other articles for his paper, so that while we're talking in Carmel, little sleepy, quiet Carmel, about what the national, international problems, this Mr. Prouty, he was a liaison between the defense and the CIA in London, was talking about memos he saw in the Pentagon. He is linking them.
I remember now where I heard about
where
him.
Where was that?
I think he was on Jim Eason's program on KGO.
Somebody heard
yes,
him up there.
Right.
Yeah. Was he talking? Did
he
they talk to him in London?
He was doing the same thing, yes.
How long ago was that?
It was just about a month ago, so I think maybe we better contact Jim and see.
Get the tapes of that
yeah,
show?
Yeah, maybe we can.
Maybe we could tie the
two
together.
At least you might be able to listen to them. And,
yeah. Well, they wanted me up there. About a year and a half ago, they wanted me on the show, but I didn't go up. I wasn't ready yet to go out into the public with the material I had because I felt I would be harassed, and I wanted to wind up what I was doing and go through those 26 volumes over and over again with a fine-tooth comb before I went out and could say, this is positively so, based upon my research. Yeah, somebody heard him up there. A friend of mine heard him.
Yeah. A friend of mine did, too, and it just while you were talking, it finally gelled. I remembered where I had heard about it.
Yeah, well, this is a city that's known for its artists.
Well, I think this is
musicians.
What is happening. We've talked about this before. We have Ellsberg, and now we have Prouty, and, of course, we have Mae Brussel right here, but
it's
coming down now.
You see, what happened is while we were talking here and making our tapes, he was talking in London about the assassination, and this particular man, Don Riley, in San Francisco, brought Capitol Hill this document, and I'm sure that what is happening back in Washington, it came just before the vacation. Everyone wants to get home, and most of the people are out working. They don't care at all, the McGoverns and the Muskies and the Ted Kennedys. They couldn't care less about what we're saying, but there's certain people in positions of power and with an intellectual curiosity, like Mendel Rivers, who wanted the My Lai thing. There are honest, decent conservatives who want to know. And Washington realizes now that they have something real. This is why I said they can't wrap it up or put it in a bag. They have something that they're going to have to go into. They can't ignore it because we're worlds apart. I don't know either of those two men. And I'm sitting with you and saying it has to be told now, and the evidence is there. And here's Mr. Prouty, who has seen memos and intimating he's seen them. And he's valuable like an Ellsberg because he has seen the working memos. And I will be valuable because I have 7 years of unwinding.
I think it would be interesting, to say the least, if you and Mr. Riley could get together.
If somebody, this program goes up to the Santa Cruz area and then reaches north, if somebody knows Don Riley, maybe we could, or maybe we could get, you know, him down here.
Why not? That's great.
But I think in some way, Gloria, it would be more effective. You see, Washington kind of wants everyone to bunch together. Like at the time of the witness of the polka dot dress in the Ambassador Hotel, a woman, Sandy Serrano, heard this lady scream out by the steps, "I saw him, and we killed him," and she had this polka dot dress, and a gentleman was with her. Well, Sandy Serrano was mingling around the room, and another man heard the same thing. So the two of them talked about what they heard, and then when they wanted to say there was no conspiracy in Los Angeles, they said that Mr. Pietra and Sandy Serrano got together and had talked about the polka dot dress, so one may have impressed the other person, and therefore it didn't exist. I think it's more effective if I go to Washington myself with my work and meet Mr. Anderson's investigator, and not seeing that 14-page document, and say that how can a woman living in Carmel, you know, taking care of a home, a philosophy major, no special training in any kind of a thing, how can she see it when the men in Washington either see it or they don't want to see it? I'll show it to them, or they're going to say, no, it's not true. Let me just read one thing. Gloria, is our time running out?
Yeah, we have about 10 minutes.
When you write your letters, and we talk about writing letters to public officials, you're going to have to reach anyone or everyone, and it's not going to be Richard Nixon or John Mitchell. And I want to read you a section of a book, because we're talking about the news of the week. U.S. News and World Report has an article this week on the number one man in the cabinet in controversy. His name, of course, is John Mitchell. He is the foe of civil rights. He's the designer of the Southern Strategy. He is the fellow, this is quotes, who can change the president's mind. He advises across the board the highest policy meetings. Now, he makes all the decisions. He was the campaign chairman for Richard Nixon. The article goes on to say, I have many articles on my filing cabinet of the background of Nixon and his law firm, but this is this week's U.S. News World Report, August the 2nd. He did not know Nixon. He was not a Nixon convert or belonged to the group of Californians associated with him. It wasn't until Mr. Nixon suffered two election defeats for president and governor of California that Mr. Nixon and Mr. Mitchell got together and became friends and law partners. Now, John Mitchell wouldn't want a loser. He wouldn't want a loser, would he? So he takes Richard Nixon and, as a campaign manager, grooms him for president and changes his mind now. When I talk about covert governments or police states, I talk about Mr. Puppet Richard Nixon. But I'm going to read you fast, we're almost off the air, from Penn Jones Jr.'s book, Forgive My Grief, Volume 3. Penn Jones has written three books on the Kennedy assassination. He lives in Texas. On page 84 and 85, the chapter is called The Head Man Was in Dallas. And he goes into the newspaper, the Dallas Times-Herald, reports society parties of various people in the area constantly, of Mrs. Clint Murchison, the oil family, or Paul Rogatorodsky, and she describes meetings at their home. But Penn Jones says, now I'm going to read the entire quotation, Forgive My Grief is the name of the book, page 85, volume 3. An earlier unreported Murchison party was much more important than those of recent years. This party was held the night of November the 21st, 1963, at the Murchison home, and we think was the cover for an important conference of the assassination staff. We always felt that before the president was killed, a staff conference was held somewhere, and the elements of the assassination plot were present. At first, they thought it was in Sykes, Louisiana, but that was the lower-level operatives. When it was realized that the assassination of President Kennedy was more important than the Normandy invasion with General Eisenhower in command, The conference for the Dallas Project becomes essential. The killing of President Kennedy was the most important takeover of a country in our world history. All the major forces in this country were involved. Riley says the FBI, the CIA. Quote again, all the major forces in the country were involved and had to be accounted for at the final conference before the strike. So a conference was necessary, and that conference was held. Since Richard M. Nixon and J. Edgar Hoover were in the Murchison home that night, November 21st, the night before the assassination, we feel we should report that that conference was held in that home, not in front of the partygoers, but on the premises, and J. Edgar Hoover, the task force commander, was present to confer with his troops, to issue last-minute instructions to review their final plans, and to give the word to go or to cancel as necessary. That nobody, when you read about the assassination, talks about Richard Nixon being in town at the time that John Kennedy was there. That is Penn Jones. I think it is very clear when you're writing to people that you have to go beyond the team that's in office now. You cannot let them tell you, we have gone into it. It is not true. If people like Senator Proxmire or Senator Fulbright or a handful of people who want to go into examining the situations in Washington or want to sue the president for holding up billions of dollars that haven't been allocated, I have a list of people who feel something's wrong, and it's up to those people, if they feel something's wrong, is to take this evidence. They should either put up or shut up now. It's time for them. If they're uninformed, I will inform them. You just write to them and say, we are hearing these things. May Brussels wants to see you. Save your letters. There's another letter, and date it, and send it off. May Brussels will meet with any of you, anytime, any day. And if you don't want to know, just say you're in a police state, and this is the way it is, and that there will be no elections in 72. Just say it, and call it what it is. That's all. Don't play with our heads. Don't mess around with us. But if you're just uninformed, she's here now, and she will inform you.
Thank you, May.
Listening to Dialogue. Dialogue is a presentation of the Public Affairs and Special Events Department of KLRB News.